This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time. And soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
If you've got big plans for this year and beyond, you're going to love our conversation today. When you get engaged in doing something that's meaningful, and by the way, you're the one who decides, the only one who decides if something's meaningful or not, it can be a little overwhelming at first. Where do you begin? How do you get started? And that's the topic of our conversation today. My guest is the author of the new book, How to Begin: Start Doing Something That Matters. My guest is Michael Bunyai-Stanier. He helps people be a force for change. His new book is How to Begin, Start Doing Something That Matters. He's best known for his book prior to that, The Coaching Habit, which sold close to 1 million copies and has thousands of five-star reviews online. He founded Box of Crayons, a learning and development company, helping organizations move from being advice-driven to curiosity-led. He's also been named a number one thought leader in coaching and a coaching guru. He left Australia about 30 years ago to become a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University, where his only significant achievement was falling in love with a Canadian, which is why he now lives in Toronto, having spent time in London and Boston. Balancing out these moments of success, he was banned from his high school graduation for the balloon incident, was sued by one of his law school professors for defamation, and his first published piece of writing was a Harlequin romance-esque story involving a misdelivered letter and called the mail, M-A-L-E, delivery. So, Michael, our listeners have just heard your bio, and I just wanted to ask, is there anything else you'd like people to know about you that's not in your bio?
Do I mention how good-looking I am? I'm not sure that I do. I don't know. You know, there's something about bios where, at their worst, they can be both tedious and intimidating at the same time. You're like, you know, it's like, I won a bronze medal for the 50-meter breaststroke in school when I was 14, you know, and it's like this list of boring accomplishments. And I have this bias to going, look, what's interesting in most people's bios is the mess and the journey and the mistakes and the scars and the accidents. You know, there's that famous Jane Austen line in one of her books, which is like, all happy families are the same, but all unhappy families are distinctively interesting. I'm like, look, all successful bios are basically the same. Look at me, I achieve stuff. But it's in the juiciness of the kind of the mess and the struggle and the blisters and the scars that you get to see people's more interesting journey. So I'm not sure.
Fair enough. So there's always the balloon incident.
Exactly. Which is a less interesting story than it is a tease, because this whole idea of being not allowed to do my high school graduation because of the balloon incident sounds like, what the hell happened? I'm like, okay. So here's the very quick story. I'm 17, finishing high school. My headmaster is finishing high school. His career as the headmaster, his story career of 40 years as the headmaster. And the class before us, the year before, had basically destroyed the school in their final day. They glue in all the locks. They brought in a flock of sheep to eat the grass in the main quadrangle. They put weed killer spelling out rude words in the other quadrangle. So, you know, it was like something came up days later. And they kind of humiliated the school and cost the school a bunch of money. So we were told in no uncertain terms, don't do anything at all to disrupt the school on your last day. And I was like, you know what? I get that. But come on. It's our last day at school. So I went to a Church of England high school. So we went into our chapel, which had a kind of conical roof. And me and some friends, we just filled some balloons up with helium so that they floated at the top of the roof. It was the most benign act of rebellion you could possibly ask for. I mean, it was ridiculous. But we'd crossed the line and a number of us got banned. And I was the ringleader, so I got my wrist slapped. And so it goes. It just set up a lifetime of trying in my very privileged, successful way to try and somehow disrupt the status quo a little bit.
So when I coach people who are leaving the world of full-time work, speaking of disrupting the status quo. And these are people that aren't quite done yet. They often want to do something meaningful, but they're not clear yet what they really want to do. And your concept of a worthy goal in your new book, How to Begin, can really help, I think. What makes something a worthy goal?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a crossroads, isn't it? Where you know, what David Brooks would call is like, are you ready to climb the second mountain? Because you've climbed the first mountain of your career and you've had success and you've got status and you're now resourced and experienced and you've got, as they call it, Nordic highlights. You've gone gray. You've got all of that. And you're like, you're 50 or 55 or 60 or 65 and you're thinking to yourself, I've got 20 good years left at least. I don't want to play golf the whole time. What am I going to do? And so this book is written because I'm 50-something, 53 or something. So I'm kind of in this space myself. And I'm like, okay, so a worthy goal is about what are you going to do with your time? There's a legacy act. So it's perfect for the folks listening to us now, Joe. And a worthy goal has three elements to it. Is it thrilling? Is it important? And is it daunting? So let me just kind of break those down a little bit. Thrilling starts with you. Do you care about this? Do you light up? Do you kind of rub your hands together and go, oh, I'm pretty stoked about this. I'm pretty excited about taking this on. This speaks to what I care about, what my values are. I'm not that great at kind of connecting to passions, but if you have passions, it's like, it's the best of who you are now. It's the best of who you want to be when you grow up. I mean, I know you're 55, but we're all still trying to figure out who we're going to be when we're growing up. So it's all of that. And that's helpful because sometimes when you get to this point, you feel like you should be doing stuff. And you know, I should be doing this. I should be volunteering. I should be writing a book. I should be starting a new business. I should be consulting. I should be who knows what. And actually, we start by just going thrilling, which is like, what do you want? What do you want to do? But if it's just that, it becomes a little self-indulgent. It might mean that you just spend your whole time playing golf. And I know that's good for a lot of people, but for some of you, I'm like, you know, you've got more to offer than getting your handicap down a little bit. So that's the important element. The important element is, do you give more to the world than you take? Because for so many people in this position, you are actually resourced. This is a place for you to think about contribution. This is the David Brooks' second mountain, which is like, how am I serving the world? How am I leaving the world a little bit better than I found it? So important really says, all right, thrilling is good, but you need to find the balance between important as well. And then the third element is daunting. So is this going to push you and stretch you and grow you? Because you know that saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks? That seemed to be true when we were all 30. But now that we're not all 30, it's not true, is it? We can teach an old dog new tricks, and we're not even that old, damn it. So the daunting is like, look, it's very clear that the way that you avoid degenerative mental diseases and physical diseases is you keep learning. It's actually not about, can I keep doing the crossword? It's like, do you still stay curious about life? Do you still stay curious about yourself and what's possible and what your potential is and what you can learn? That is it. That is a silver bullet to aging as well as you can, as long as you can. So daunting invites you to ask the question, so is this going to stretch and grow me? Because a temptation is, when you're as accomplished as the people listening to this podcast are, you can do stuff that is thrilling and important, but it's in your comfort zone because you've done it. And as good as it is to tap into that experience, like, where's the learning edge for you?
What gets in the way of people starting to do new things that matter?
That's a big question. And the kind of the headline would be this. We are far more attached to the status quo than we realize. And the truth is that as you kind of get a little older in your life, there's all sorts of ways that the status quo whispers in you and goes, look, just keep it on the down low. Everything's fine. Everything's good. It's, why would you muck any of this up? And I do think that when you say, look, I'm actually interested in taking on a worthy goal, that is an act of disruption. It disrupts your own expectations of yourself. It disrupts some people's expectations of who you are and what you should be doing and how you should be behaving. It puts the time you're investing in it at risk. It might put some money or some resource at risk. And in many ways, there's this real clear understanding, which is like the status quo is a bit of a black hole. It just keeps pulling you towards it going, look, don't make waves. Everything's going to be fine. And I want people to be a force for change. And I want this audience in particular, because we are the resourced generation. And there's a trope, which is like, well, the world's going to hell a little bit, but you know, the youth will save us. And I'm like, I hope the youth will save us, but I don't want us to be sitting around going, ah, it's good. I'll play golf because the youth are going to save us. I'm like, no, let's help the youth save us. Let's save ourselves. Let's contribute as best we can.
So meaningful goals, things that matter, that can be overwhelming.
Mm.
And what I really like about the process that you lay out in the book is that it helps you craft and thoughtfully sharpen these worthy goals, not just to set a goal and go off running to chase it. What are the high-level stages and steps in the process?
Yeah, thank you. So the book has 9 chapters and 3 sections. So each section has 3 chapters to it. And broadly, there are 3 stages to begin. Because I can't get you to the end of your goal, I'm trying to get you across the threshold. So step number 1 is to define your worthy goal. And I like how you said it, Joe, because it points to one first place where people go wrong is that they don't interrogate their goals with enough rigor. You know, they come up with an idea, you know, we're a little bit past December the 31st. So sometimes you've got a glass of champagne in your hand going, right, 2022, what am I going to do? I haven't thought too hard about it, but you know what? This sounds okay. So why don't I do this? I'm like, okay, that's a good start, but quite frankly, we all know how New Year's resolutions tend to go. There's a fitness app called Strava, and they call January the 12th. Actually, I think it's January the 14th, which is the day we're recording it. So they call that quitting day, because it's about now that everyone's like, ah, yeah, said I was going to exercise. Clearly, I'm not. So I want you to interrogate your worthy goal. So not just come up with an idea, but then tweak it and polish it and draft it. I'm a writer. Joe, you're a writer as well. We all know that the way our books get better is by drafting it and then drafting it again and drafting it again. Do the same with your worthy goals. Polish them until they feel that they've got that just that right combo of thrilling, important, and daunting that you're like, this feels good. That's stage 1. Stage 2 is figuring out whether you're really ready to commit. This is also something that people often step over or miss. Once you have a worthy goal, it feels like the right thing to do is to start doing it. But I want you to really stop and just wrestle with that issue around the status quo we were just talking about, which is like, if you take this on, what are the prizes and punishments of doing that? Because there are advantages. Everything you're imagining is the outcome of your worthy goal. But there are disadvantages. There's stuff you're putting at risk. And then your other choice is actually not taking this on, kind of stepping away from this and going, you know, this is not, I'm just not going to do it. And then again, you want to ask yourself prizes and punishments. What would I get from not taking this on? Broadly speaking, maintaining the status quo. But what would I lose? All the possibilities that resonant in that worthy goal. And then the third broad area is crossing the threshold. Because once you've figured it out and once you've committed to it, you've got to take the first few steps, because too many of us have come up with actually wonderful goals, really powerful. And then somehow we've just lost our mojo. We haven't got going on it. And you know, everybody's heard the quote, the journey of 10,000 miles starts with a single step. Take the step, cross the threshold, take more than one step, take 3 steps, and just start moving into the experience of actually doing your worthy goal. And that's where the magic starts to happen.
Very helpful. Thank you. And just a quick thing on quitting day. I was on a Zoom call earlier this week, Monday.
Yeah.
And the person running the call said, let's all start with sharing our New Year's resolutions. Person 1, I am stoked and pumped about 2022. I've set 3 resolutions. I just can't remember them. This is on January 10th.
Exactly. I'm like, I've got 3 thrilling resolutions, which I'm sure I've written down somewhere. Exactly. And what you hope with a worthy goal is it becomes a place that you can constantly direct your attention and resource and time, because it is the thing that is kind of you're building your life around. I mean, we've all heard the metaphor of, you know, somebody holding a jar and they've got pebbles and rocks and sand and the like. Like, it matters what order you put it in to maximize the volume filled in that jar. start with a bigger rock, and worthy goal is those bigger rocks.
So what can we get wrong about resistance?
Yeah. Wonderful question. There's two things that you can get wrong about it. The first is thinking that you're not going to experience resistance because of course you're going to experience resistance. You pick something that is thrilling and important and daunting. Like that's a combination that is guaranteed to serve up a side serving of resistance as part of it. And sometimes when we meet that resistance, our reaction is to go, oh, well, too hard, too difficult, too weird. I'm going to quit, or I'm going to, retroactively make it sound like I never committed to this thing in the first place. You know, you find a way of sidestepping the commitment that you made. And actually, and this is the second thing, which is like, I think resistance is something to be celebrated, because here's what I realized. In so many ways, committing to a worthy goal is like undertaking the hero's journey. Now, lots of us have heard of the hero's journey. It's certainly not the only type of metaphorical journey to take, but it's a useful model and it rings true for lots of us. You know, and broadly speaking, the hero's journey is the hero's in her world. She hears the call to adventure. She crosses the threshold. She moves into the darkness, often with a team around her, a mentor and a trickster and whoever else. They finally meet the monster. They vanquish the monster. And then she turns around and with bearing the prize treasure from the monster, you know, she brings it back through the darkness, back over into the light. And the gift changes her community and it changes her as well. And as many of us know, that Star Wars, the first Star Wars movie, is the perfect embodiment of that. George Lucas actually spent time with the guy who first kind of fully articulated the hero's journey as a way of going, this is how I'm structuring this movie. But here's the thing that overview misses and is often missed around the hero's journey. One of the steps of the hero's journey, which I think actually has like 12 or 13 steps in it, is that when the hero first hears the call, they resist the call. They go, nope, that's not for me. And if you've seen the Star Wars movie, you know that's what happens. Like our young hero, Luke Skywalker, is like, I need to go and do this. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do it. And then finally he's like, no, I need to do it. And he's taken off and he's off to try and meet Darth Vader and meet the monster and all of that good stuff. So when you notice resistance, rather than going, this is a bad thing and I should give up, what it's really saying to you is this is the right path to be on. Or at least it's not 100% guarantee, but I'm like, if this is likely the right path to be on. So don't see this as an invitation to give up. See this as an invitation to straighten up, lengthen the back, relax the front, as somebody once said, and start going, great. And notice the resistance, press on. How am I going to do that?
One of my favorite books on the hero's journey, Richard Rohr, Falling Upward. Great title. Talking about how...
Oh, I don't know that book.
He's a priest in New Mexico and very, very interesting. But it's about the journey in the second half of life and that it's transcending the hero's journey as to now what. And it's a clever title, Falling Upward. But it really, really gets at the whole aspect that you're talking about. So it's really listening to the signal that this is the right path. So time to be resilient.
Yeah. But it also speaks to the fact that it's not an easy path that you're choosing when you're taking on a worthy goal. It's going to have difficulties ahead of it. And it means that when you cross the threshold, you want to give yourself the best chance of navigating that resistance and navigating those difficulties. And, you know, one of the key lessons in the book is don't travel alone. And, you know, there's depressing research about how bad people are at having friends and having inner circles. And it's worse for men than it is for women. And I don't think there's research that says this. It's like, there's just like lots of us are lonely. And I suspect that if you're, you know, you're retiring and you're moving away from a community that work gives you, because you're just, you know, you've thrown into it a whole bunch of people that you have to work with and there's relationships, weak or strong, that form from that. When you retire, you're like, where's this connection? Where's this community? And so one of the powers of a worthy goal is that it almost demands that you build a band, build people around you so you're not traveling alone. And it's an opportunity for you to say, well, who do I call in? Where do I find people? And there's often reluctance around that. And you can understand why. It's like, I don't want to risk rejection. But somebody went, I thought this is so wonderful, powerful insight. Nobody likes to be the first to say hello, but everybody loves to be greeted. So I do think this, and I'm trying to do a better job of this myself, is just to ask myself, how do I be the person who reaches out and says hello? You know, whether that's me just nodding at somebody as I'm walking along the street, calling somebody up and going, hey, how you doing? Or calling somebody up and going, look, I've got this project. I'd love to talk to you about it. Maybe you'd even like to play a role in it in some form or another.
So ultimately, though, as you write about, you only really get traction with action.
Mm.
And you have a great list of action verbs in the book.
That's right.
And now you've birthed this latest book, and now you're out in the world talking about it. When you think of that list, what are three action verbs that most resonate with you now?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, whenever a guest goes, that's an interesting question, it means they don't have a good answer. They're playing for time. I'm just playing for time here, folks. So, you know, this book launched this week. And when you're an author, you know, Joe and I were talking about this because Joe's got a book coming out in the world soon enough. There's this period of time you have where your book's written and you're waiting. You're waiting for it to show up to the world and you're not entirely sure how it will be received. And you go through cycles of excitement and doubt and elation and despair. And so there's been a very large verb that's been in front of my face for the last 3 months at least, which is launch. The word is launch. Launch the book. So now I'm just starting to turn my attention to what my next worthy goal might be, because launching this book it's not the end of that worthy goal, but it's a significant section of the worthy goal. I plan to kind of champion this book for at least another year. So I'll be talking about it on podcasts and places like this, but you know, it's launched and that's a big part of it. So a verb that's really powerful for me is to create and to actually more specifically to write. Like I'm playing with an identity that I've never assumed before, which is that of a writer. Now I've written maybe 6 or 7 books. So people who know my work will be confused by that because they're like, you're already a writer, you write books. I'm like, yeah, I know. But actually, I write books so far in the service of other things that I'm doing. It helps my business, it builds courses around it, stuff like that. But a writer makes writing the central part of what they do, not a peripheral part of what they do. So I think writing is one of those verbs. And other verb that I think is really important is nurturing. So I have a really small team and we all work too hard, in part because I'm cheap, in part because I'm not totally great at hiring people. I mean, sometimes I am, but sometimes I'm not. So this year and this next 3 months for me certainly is trying to build have some hires and build some structures that create space for this team to feel nurtured. So they're not working themselves to exhaustion, but they're working in a way that is sustainable. So I think those are the two verbs that I can see at the moment that feel important to me.
I appreciate that. And you mentioned before the power of daunting. And what I see, people have been successful at work and they start to quote unquote retire. They grapple with the loss of the right degree of challenge. They've got a lot of free time, but maybe they miss that daunting more than they thought they would. And you write in the book, unlocking greatness, you can unlock greatness by doing hard things. How can people embrace the value of doing hard things versus that life of leisure?
Well, let me turn the question to you, Joe. How do you navigate that?
So for me, it's about thinking about ways in which I can redeploy my skills in the service of others. So for me, coming from an HR background, it was natural to go into coaching, but only because I had a great coach. And I had a coach for a year back in the year 2000. For a year, because I must have been a hard case in retrospect. And I thought, boy, this is interesting to see what happened. So I want to do that.
Yeah.
But I think it's finding the right balance for that person. For me, I try to look at what's the right constellation of things
Yeah.
that really fit For me, it's a combination of work, family, sports. Very big into sports. I have been a runner, although I broke my hip with a half mile to go in the Boston Marathon in 2016. So I had to shift to running indoors.
That's disappointing.
But great story. Some good things happen for him, which is good. But I think it's around finding that right mix. And I know a lot of people I work with get hung up on, what's my new purpose? Singular. Actually, think of it more of a multi-purpose retirement, because create the right portfolio of things you're involved in, and one thing might start to emerge.
Yeah. Well, see, I think that what will emerge is actually an interesting way of thinking about this. And it's how I think about it as well, which is you can spend a lot of time trying to figure out the purpose of it all. And it can all feel a bit abstract and a bit theoretical. And you're like, okay, I've got words, but do I care about them really? I'm not sure. And I think there's a parallel here to when people go, well, look, just follow your passion or just work on your passion. And I've never loved that advice because I'm like, passion's not really a word I use. And I'm not sure what my passion is. And even if I had passion, do I want to monetize it? Do I want to operationalize it and systematize it? I'm not totally sure. It feels caging a wild bird, if to use that metaphor. I think part of what I like about the idea of setting a worthy goal and working a worthy goal is it comes sideways at what your purpose is. If you're asking questions about thrilling and important and daunting, that's actually asking questions about your purpose without actually asking you about your purpose. And I think what happens when you start doing your worthy goal is you start seeing stuff emerging that tells you more clearly what the thing is that you might want to be working on. Because part of why this book is called How to Begin rather than How to Wrap It All Up is that once you begin, it becomes an emergent journey. And what you think is the finish line might not be the finish line. And what you think is the project might not even be the project in the end. It's about getting going. So when you reference that quote from the book, we unlock our greatness by working on the hard stuff. It's not we unlock our greatness by naming our purpose. And it's not we unlock our greatness by picking up the trophy at the end. It's by working on the hard stuff. And that's why this kind of conversation around verbs and doing and making stuff happen. And I love the phrase you had around traction needs action. It's like it's in the doing that the interesting stuff happens. So take your best guess at a worthy goal. Work it a little bit. So it's not just a random guess, but you've increased the odds that you're in the right direction. Then try some stuff out and see what shows up. And stuff happens. Like you start a podcast and like 5 years later, I'm like, I love this podcast. It's a central part to what I do. I didn't think it would be. Now it is.
And it's that having that experimenting attitude, the mindset. Like you talk about trying things. Yeah, it can be really so key. So doing things that matter. That's not something that's theoretical for you. You've pursued many worthy goals. And one that struck me at the time that you did it was your involvement in Malaria No More. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of that worthy goal?
Yeah, thank you. I'm super proud of this. And I don't get asked about it very often. So thank you for asking. So 10 years ago, actually 12 years ago, 2010, I wrote a book called Do More Great Work. And it's a sister to How to Begin. Because in Do More Great Work, I'm saying, look, great work. There are three types of work. There's bad work, mind-numbing, soul-sucking bureaucracy. There's good work. It's your job description, which you have whether you have a job or not. And then great work is the work that has more impact and the work that has more meaning. And in Do More Great Work, I kind of advocate like I do in How to Begin, or like the power of doing a project, worthy goal. So I finish Do More Great Work. I get it out into the world. Pretty excited because it's kind of my first kind of grown-up formal book. Totally my first book, but it's the first one published by a New York publisher and all that sort of stuff. And in the book, I'm like, okay, do a great work project. I should probably follow my own advice and do a great work project. Okay. So I went around the corner to my local coffee shop called Cherry Bomb, ordered an espresso and an almond croissant. They do great almond croissant. And I'm like, okay, so what do I know about? Well, I don't know much, but I know a bit about getting books written. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And I'm like, what scale of impact am I interested in? I'm like, actually, I try and think big about that. I mean, a worthy goal can be intimate, it can be big, it can be broad, but I like broad. So I'm like, okay, so what are the UN millennial goals? And one of the UN millennial goals is trying to eliminate malaria, which is the most deadly disease humankind has faced over its long history, killed millions. I was like, okay, I can't remember where I got this idea from exactly, but I got this idea of what if I create a book where the equation was one book equals one mosquito net. And we find a way of taking the money from the profit of the book and giving it to a charity who buys mosquito nets, because mosquito nets are one of the tools in the fight against malaria. So I took it back to the publisher who did do more great work, and they're like, maybe it's complicated. It was complicated because if you're an author, you don't get the money from the book sales till 9 months after the book is launched. And it's like, it's too complicated. So honestly, I abandoned the idea. But then the publisher of Workman, who had moved on to another publishing imprint, called me up and went, look, Seth Godin has just doing this thing where he's partnering with Amazon and producing books. Maybe you want to pitch your end malaria idea to Seth Godin. So I did. I knew Seth a little bit. And he went, sure. And so in a very rapid way, we put this book together. And because of his relationship with Amazon, actually, not just the profit, but all the revenue from the book went to Malaria No More. And so the book hit number two on Amazon overall, which was very exciting, and raised about $400,000 to buy mosquito nets. So it was a cool project. They don't always work out quite as neatly as that, but it worked out pretty well.
A worthy goal indeed.
Yeah, thank you.
So like many of us, you've also navigated transitions. And one of the examples that you illustrate in the book, and I might say with trademark humility and humor,
thanks,
is transitioning from the CEO role of the company you founded, Box of Crayons. I'm curious, what lessons have you learned about transitioning well?
Well, it's hard at the best of time. It's really hard. Well, it's differently and particularly hard if you're a founder. If you founded a company and you put 20 years of your own DNA into this, even if you're not necessarily kind of front and center of the company anymore, there's a lot of you entangled in that. And I think the key thing I learned was it's really helpful to have support when you move through transition. You know, when I was pretty excited about not being the CEO at Box of Crayons, because honestly, I wasn't a great CEO. I've got some significant limitations at that leadership thing and some structural ones, which is, it's my company, and I just don't care enough about the money to kind of really drive it to the next level of success. I do care about the impact I want that company to have, but I just wasn't sure that I was going to be the right person to lead it. So I'm like, I need a new CEO. And I had a young, brilliant woman in the company who I thought was going to be that person. So one way of doing that would be to me to say, hey, Shannon, in 6 months' time, you're going to be the CEO. Good luck. And then in 6 months' time, walk out of the office, the metaphorical office, and go right over to you. And then probably come back and keep my fingers stuck in the pie for this, that, and the other, and basically inevitably undermine Shannon. And one of the things that we did, which made all the difference, was we hired a coach, and we hired her for 2 years. It wasn't my coach, and it wasn't Shannon's coach. It was our transition coach. And Jill spent us a year leading up to the moment of Shannon becoming the CEO, basically getting us ready, exploring how we might collude against this working, helping do a kind of transmission as best I could from what I knew about being a CEO to Shannon, who'd never been a CEO before. And then a year after that, to kind of effectively and mostly to stop me meddling and stop me screwing up a good thing. So it's, I think one of the things I've learned is it takes longer than you think, and actively managing the support around that can be really great. Because after I walked away from being the CEO at Box of Crayons, something that I was super excited to do, I spent a year, a bit longer perhaps, a little bit kind of wandering around aimlessly. Hey, what the hell am I doing? Who am I now? What's the point? But what's the purpose? How do I get going on this? And you know, part of where How Begin is written is it's written out of the experience of me going through that transition and trying to figure some stuff out.
And luckily, you didn't ask yourself, what are my passions?
Exactly. Well, in some ways, my passions around championing coaching and making coaching more accessible for people, which I didn't have when I started Box of Crayons, but which emerged through the work, actually then became a bit of a hindrance, because I was like, I was finding it really hard to think beyond just that, because I had that experience so deeply in my bones. And it took a bit of time to kind of shake that off and then kind of get out of the coaching and box of crayons valley and over the hump into the next valley, into this next world.
So let's imagine a point in time where you run across an annoying podcast host who's looking for a clever question to end with and limits you to 5 words to describe the benefits of your new book for people listening. What would you say?
Rediscovers your ambition. I need a few more than 5 words. Rediscovers ambition for self and world.
I did not expect you to color within the lines.
I didn't. It was like 6 words. That's close.
Very, very close.
I need to disrupt the status quo just a little bit.
Yes. Well, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate it. Wish you all the best with your book and other things coming that are tied to it. Certainly, I'll be watching closely. And thank you for all that I've learned going way back to the Great Work podcast, which was a great learning experience for me and really enjoyed that.
I love the fact that you're an early listener of that. That was a thrill to find out. So thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks, Michael. Time for takeaways. What caught your attention that's actionable? What are you bringing into action after this conversation? I have 4 things that I wrote down to keep in mind. And I've read his book. It's a great book. Highly recommend. It's a very short book. His books tend to be. It's very easy to read. It's very action-oriented. It's humorous, but practical. A lot of funny little things in it, but it's very, very well done and very valuable resource. Here are my 4 things. First up, don't just jump into a goal. Invest the time to build it right. If you have a worthy goal in mind, take the time to clarify it, reality test it, and then assess your level of commitment before forging ahead. Second, I really liked his point about you really want to set a worthy goal that's based on something you really want to do, not something you think you should be doing. Number 3, make friends with resistance. If you're doing something meaningful, doing something that matters, taking on something new, resistance, as he said, is going to appear. So expect it, befriend it, celebrate it, as he suggests, and then know it's a signal that you're on the right path to something meaningful. And last but not least, I loved his comment about keep learning. Keep trying something new, keep being curious, and keep pursuing your worthy goals. Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. Our mission is to help you balance your retirement planning and help you design the next life that you've earned after you leave the world of full-time work. Planning for retirement goes well beyond your 401k or your IRA. How will you invest your time after work is not your central focus? You'll need another portfolio. I help people create an active multi-purpose retirement with the right mix of interests, activities, and pursuits that are going to be right for you, so you can invest your time wisely. And for many, like me, it still includes some version of work that's redefined on your own terms. Visit our website, retirementwisdom.com. You'll find resources there, some tools, and you can schedule a call if you'd like to discuss the 2 programs that I offer, individual one-on-one coaching and group programs for designing your life that can help you retire smarter. Look forward to talking again with some interesting guests in the weeks to come. Thanks for listening.